Our gospel reading comes to us this morning from the Gospel of John. It's the story of Mary Magdalene at the tomb, beginning in chapter 20, verse 1 and 11 through 18. Hear now these words. Early on the first day of the week, while it was still dark, Mary Magdalene came to the tomb and saw that the stone had been removed from the tomb. But Mary stood weeping outside the tomb. And as she wept, she bent over to look into the tomb, and she saw two angels in white sitting where the body of Jesus had been lying, one at the head and the other at the feet. And they said to her, "Woman, why are you weeping?" And she said to them, "They have taken away my Lord, and I do not know where they have laid him." And when she had said this, she turned around and saw Jesus standing there, but she did not know that it was Jesus. Jesus said to her, "Woman, why are you weeping? Whom are you looking for?" And supposing him to be the gardener, she said to him, "Sir, if you have carried him away, tell me where you have laid him, and I will take him away." Jesus said to her, "Mary." She turned and said to him in Hebrew, "Rabboni," which means teacher. And Jesus said to her, "Do not hold on to me, because I have not yet ascended to the Father. But go to my brothers and say to them, 'I am ascending to my Father and your Father, to my God and your God.'" Mary went and announced to the disciples, "I have seen the Lord." And she told them that he had said these things to her. This is the gospel of the Lord. Thanks be to thee, O Christ. You may be seated. Lately, I've been thinking, or considering, as Paul would say, I've been considering my own call. Paul considers how God used the weakness of Jesus and the weakness and the scandal of the cross to bring about new life in our world. But I've been thinking about my own call and sometimes how God chooses those who seem least likely to do things, or call us when we seem reluctant to do things. I've been thinking about my call and how it's come abruptly about 25 years ago, seemed out of nowhere. I was attending a spiritual retreat one weekend, and I was asked by the minister in charge if I would help serve communion. And I said, sure, I was really eager to help, but I didn't really know what to do, but he told me. And so they received, like we do, by intinction here on Sunday mornings. And so as I was holding the chalice and saying to each person as they came forward, "The blood of Christ shed for you. The blood of Christ poured out for you. The blood of Christ given for you." Something surreal happened, and I sensed God saying, "This is what you're supposed to be doing." But I wondered, what does this mean? Does this mean I'm supposed to become a more involved lay leader in the church? Does this mean I'm supposed to go to seminary to be a better educated Sunday school teacher? Or does this mean I'm supposed to go to seminary and that God is calling me to ordained ministry? And while the answers to those questions were not clear at the time, what was certain in that moment is that I had had this experience with God that wouldn't allow me to continue life as usual. I had to think about all of this. And throughout my ministry journey, I have been humbled and worried oftentimes that perhaps someone else would have been better suited or better prepared to what God or the church was calling me to in any given moment or year or day. I mean, after all, I didn't grow up in the big city of Dallas. I grew up in a small farming community, and I attended this tiny little church, and it was wonderful and nurturing and caring, but it also didn't allow women in ministry. I didn't know such a thing existed, and it certainly wouldn't have allowed a woman in a pulpit. So many Sunday mornings now, I pull into our parking lot here as the sun is rising over the beautiful Gothic tower, and I say, "How did I get here, Lord?" And I know it's because God led me here and called me here. And I say, "Thank you for allowing me the privilege of serving you in this time, in this place, even though I feel so unworthy to do so." And sometimes I sense this same uncertainty and this unworthiness in other people that I teach and lead in classes. And they say to me things like, I don't think that God speaks as God did in ages past. I don't think God has need for me and my paltry gifts. I think God only chooses, you know, those heroes of the faith, the powerful, the popular, those who are influencers. But God doesn't need me. And I say, oh, you're so wrong. So their uncertainty in my experiences and struggles and joys in my own call to ministry prompted me to write a Bible study a couple of years ago for this class that I teach. And we studied the call stories of six of my favorite biblical characters, how they each heard God's voice differently in their lives and how they responded to their call, how God called them uniquely, and how we in turn hear God's call on our own lives and respond to those calls. And what was apparent in these stories is that God has this peculiar way of tapping those who seem least likely to do great things for God, to do great things for God. Those being called in these stories feel as if they are either that they're not good enough, that they're unworthy, that they are either too old, too young, too inexperienced, too fallible, sometimes too female. And yet God assures them, no matter what other people think of them or they think of themselves, that they are worthy of their call not because of who they are, but because of the one who calls them. They are, as we would say today, good to go. And of all the call stories in the Bible, I think the one to me that is the most intimate and gripping is the story of Mary Magdalene. For centuries and until just recently, Mary Magdalene has gotten a really bad rap from history and the church. She was considered one of the leading bad girls of the Bible. But actually, if we look closely at the biblical narratives of Mary, they portray her in a much different light. We find in her a woman who is central in proclaiming the resurrection. We find a faithful and obedient follower of Jesus Christ. We find a woman whose faith and whose example that we would all really do well to follow. And so let's talk about her a little bit. Mary Magdalene. Her name sounds almost melodic, doesn't it? It's beautiful. She was from Magdala, a fishing village on the west coast or the shore of the Sea of Galilee, where she probably met Jesus as he was teaching there. And in Luke's gospel, Mary is said to be part of this group of women who follow Jesus and they provide for his needs. She has been cured of 7 demons by Jesus. And she must have been a woman of means because she is one of those who helped provide for him and the 12 disciples. And we don't know what being cured of 7 demons means. Mary may have had epilepsy. She might have had mental illness. Those were 2 conditions sometimes associated with demons in the first century. But what we do know of her is that her life had been a wreck, and Jesus brought healing and wholeness into it. And we can only imagine that Jesus' healing brought with it also this incredible gratitude and this desire to reciprocate in some way for all that he had done for her in her life. Her healing brought this desire to follow him more closely and to stay near him. And providing for him, I would think, as we think about those who've given so much to us and we want to give back, providing for him seemed like a privilege to her. But it may have seemed scandalous to others. At least in 591 AD, Pope Gregory the Great, reading in the Gospel of Luke, conflates 2 other stories surrounding the story of Mary, where unnamed women are called sinful, and they are engaging in things that seem inappropriate, very inappropriate to Gregory. And so 5 centuries after Mary Magdalene's story is written in the Bible and the scriptures, Mary Magdalene is labeled by Pope Gregory as being demon-possessed, a sinner, and a prostitute. She is given little credence as an important figure in our faith, and historically, of course, Mary's gotten this bad rap. However, If we look at our scriptures, Jesus always treats her with love and dignity, and she reciprocates with her faithfulness. And in turn for her faithfulness, Jesus gives her one of the greatest responsibilities and privileges of any of his disciples. So we find in Mary, we think one of the reasons why he gives her this privilege is because Mary has staying power. She stays at the cross when others have fled. She stays to see where Jesus is buried after his death. And in the Gospel of John, she alone wakes up early on Easter morning from a grief-disturbed sleep and makes her way through the darkened streets of Jerusalem back to the tomb to be near the body of her Lord. And when she gets there, her grief, as we read this morning, is doubled. She finds that the stone has been rolled away. She assumes the grave has been robbed, and so she runs back to get Peter and the beloved disciples, saying, "They've taken the Lord from the tomb." Literally, a foot race ensues between Peter and the beloved disciple, and they get to the tomb, and they perceive that something has happened because the grave clothes are lying neatly there. It couldn't have been robbers, but they don't understand what's happened, and they shrug their shoulders and go home. But Mary stays, because that's what Mary does. She is desperate to find Jesus. We too are called to stay close to Jesus, to keep searching for Jesus, and even when it doesn't seem as if he is nearby. And when we do, and we offer ourselves to him out of gratitude for all that he's done for us, remarkable things happen. Jesus defies our expectations, as he does for Mary. So Mary is weeping outside the tomb, and she's so distraught she doesn't realize that the two people that she sees there are angels asking her, "Woman, why are you weeping?" And she answers, "They've taken my Lord away, and I don't know where they've laid him." This situation has become so personal for Mary, so intimate. "My Lord is missing, and I don't know where he is." And then she turns around, as we know, this is really almost this sweet, poignant, and a little comical scene. She turns around and sees Jesus there. She doesn't recognize who he is out of her grief and her panic. And he asks her the same question the angels do. "Woman, why are you weeping? Whom are you looking for?" And Mary, even though she's blinded, is still tenacious. I can just see her tapping her foot and almost shaking her finger in Jesus' face, begging the one that she wants to see more than anything to show her where he is. And she goes, "Sir, if you've taken him, just let me know." And then she turns her back to continue her search. And she hears this word, "Mary." And even with her back to him, she recognizes this voice that she has heard calling her name 1,000 times before. It's Jesus. "Oh my gosh, it's Jesus." And so she turns and spins and says, "Teacher, it's you." Jesus defies her expectations. She goes to the tomb looking for the body of her dear friend, and she discovers, is rewarded for her staying and searching. She is rewarded with this encounter of the risen Lord. And grief and panic are replaced by joy. I mean, haven't we all experienced something like this in our lives, where we're so consumed by maybe grief or fear or panic that it was difficult to see Jesus in our midst? Maybe we let our demons of anger or bitterness or addiction cloud our ability to know that Jesus Christ is really standing near us all the time. I mean, have you ever felt as if you've been running around looking for Jesus everywhere, only to see emptiness and loss? And then at some point you realize he's been here all along, standing beside you through your pain, tenderly calling your name and inviting you to experience a life of resurrection. In John's gospel, Jesus tells his disciples, and I would bet that Mary was standing nearby listening as well, "I am the good shepherd. My sheep hear and recognize my voice. I know them and they follow me. Friends, Jesus knows you and me. The question is, are we able to recognize his voice when he calls us? And the way we learn to recognize this voice is through what John Wesley would call the means of grace, through staying near him in worship and Bible study and receiving the sacraments and in serving others in need, of offering ourselves out of our gratitude to God. In immersing ourselves in these means of grace, we become better and better attuned to being able to hear Jesus' voice when he calls. For those who stay close, there is not only the joy and the reward of having this encounter with the risen Christ, there is also a call to go and tell. The one who stays and searches finds Jesus. Mary, in her excitement, wants, as we all would, wants to cling to Jesus, to hang on, to hold on to the one that she has finally found. And he says, Mary, you can't hold on to me. And these words from Jesus are not a rebuke. They're a reminder to Mary that life with him is not going to be the same as it was before. If she holds on comfortably to the way things were or to who she thought Jesus was, the world will remain the same. He must ascend to his Father and her Father, to his God and her God. She is a beloved child of God. And while Jesus will always be with her, he reminds her that she can't stay in that moment with him. She must go. Mary is given the incredible privilege of becoming, as the early church dubbed her, the apostle to the apostles. She delivers the first sermon of the Christian faith to her brothers and sisters. I have seen the Lord. Don't you wish all sermons were that short? And while we can't stay comfortably clinging to our pews on Sunday mornings, we can't stay comfortably clinging to Jesus from these pews. Even though it's from here that we experience his presence, it's here often that we hear his voice, we can't stay here. We're called to go, to take the message into others' darkness. Zan Holmes, a famous African-American preacher, once said, he tells the story of a time when he was marching with Martin Luther King Jr. during the Civil Rights Movement. And as the march passed a Catholic church, one of the priests from inside took the processional cross and he came running outside into the streets and got in front of the march with the cross leading the way. And as they're marching along, one of his congregants is also standing in the street, and she sees him, and she goes running up to the priest and says, Father, you take that cross back into the church where it belongs. Yeah. Holmes posed the question, if the cross doesn't belong in the streets, where does it belong? That's where Jesus did so much of his healing and teaching and feeding, taking care of others. Sometimes I wonder if I've been clinging too closely to Jesus, to my Bible study, to teaching, to preaching. I love all of those things. Means of grace are great ways of getting to know Jesus, of hearing his voice, but getting out among his sheep allows us to see the resurrected one in action. It allows us to be Jesus's resurrection in action. I don't know about you, but I have seen the Lord, and I know you have too. I have seen the Lord in the beaming faces of those that you have served through our Christmas drives. I've seen the Lord as you work with those in our disability ministries. I've seen the Lord as you feed people at Austin Street Center and through Meals on Wheels. I have seen the Lord in countless ways as you generously reciprocate the goodness and the healing that Jesus has offered to you by offering the same to his children. Mary was considered this automatic second-class citizen in her day because she was a woman, and a single woman's witness really didn't count for much. She was viewed through much of history as a sinner and demon-possessed and not worthy of her call. But she was deemed by the risen Christ as good enough to go, to be the first to go and share the good news of the resurrection, to bring the good news of light and new life into the darkness of all Jesus' followers' lives, men and women, as she proclaimed, "I have seen the Lord." You too are called in word and deed to proclaim, "I have seen the Lord." It doesn't matter where you are in life. It doesn't matter how old or young, how rich or poor, how worthy or unworthy you feel. You are a healed and beloved child of God. And in the eyes of the Lord, you are good to go. Amen.